This is episode 117 of the Prepper Website Podcast. Today's articles are Poison Ivy, Oak, and Others, What is Your Prepper Resume, and DIY Mosquito Trap That Really Works. Hey, I'm Todd Sepulveda, the editor of PrepperWebsite.com. This podcast is an audible version with some commentary of articles that have been posted on Prepper Website, a daily aggregator of preparedness information. These articles are some of the best that have been recently posted on PrepperWebsite.com. All article links and show information can be found on the PrepperWebsitePodcast.com. Our first article comes to us from doomandbloom.net. Two of my favorite people in preparedness, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. And again, the article is Poison Ivy, Oak, and Others. So let's go ahead and get right into it. And I'll say this right off the bat. This is probably one of the ones that you want to go visit. There's a lot of pictures links on this one. Whether you're outdoors due to a major disaster or just on a wilderness hike, it's possible that you'll run afoul of poisonous plants. If you live in the continental United States, expect to find poison ivy, poison oak, poison sumac, and others in the environment. 350,000 cases of poison ivy alone are recorded in the United States every year. The typical trifoliate appearance of poison ivy and another poisonous plant, poison oak, has led to the saying, "Leaves of three, let it be." Poison ivy's leaves appear almond-shaped, while poison oak looks like, well, oak leaves. There are various subtypes. Some are vein-like, others short and shrubby. Still others appear as ground cover. There are, of course, plants that are perfectly harmless that come in leaves of three. Other poisonous plants, like poison sumac, have a different look. Poison sumac has 7 to 13 pointy leaflets and can grow into a small tree upwards of 20 feet in height. Poison wood is a relative that prefers subtropical areas like the Florida Keys. It is thought that inhaling smoke from burning sumac and poison wood can cause life-threatening respiratory distress. What causes poison ivy rash? The common factor that makes all of the above plants dangerous is the compound urushiol. Urushiol is an oily resin that can be found on just about every part of the plant, including vines, leaves, and roots. The chemical irritant sticks to the skin on contact and causes symptoms in 85% of those exposed. As poison ivy rash is essentially an allergic reaction, it is not in and of itself contagious. However, any clothing or body parts that have urushiol on them can cause symptoms when touched by others. As an aside, the presence of urushiol in poison ivy and other plants appear not to be a defense mechanism. Instead, it serves to help them retain water. Deer, birds, and other wildlife can eat poison ivy without ill effects. Diagnosis and treatment. The rash of poison ivy, oak, and sumac causes itching and a red bumpy rash within a day or two of exposure. The rash continues to spread for a few days and lasts for up to 3 weeks, more in some cases. Breaks in the skin from itching can cause secondary infections that can become serious. It's sometimes difficult to make the diagnosis. Most don't realize that they were exposed during their time outdoors. Exposure may also occur indirectly, for example, by petting the fur of a pet that has been outside. The rash might appear in winter and confuse health providers, but even plants that are dormant can cause reactions. Therefore, a red, bumpy, itchy rash in anyone who has been in the great outdoors or near others who have, including pets, should raise your suspicions. Either poison oak, ivy, or sumac exists just about everywhere in North America, except perhaps mountaintop and desert environments. As such, it should always be on the list of possibilities in wilderness settings. Once you have determined that there have been exposure to poison ivy, it's important to wash the exposed area and clothing with soap and water as quickly as possible. Urushiol isn't easy to remove, however, so you might consider soaps that are effective against resin or oils such as Fels naphtha or Technu. Common treatments for poison ivy, oak, and sumac rashes include hydrocortisone cream, calamine lotion, capsaicin cream, and antihistamines like diphenhydramine, Benadryl. Some recommend the use of rubbing alcohol on the exposed areas. Cool compresses may Cool compresses are thought to be soothing. There are many home remedies that are also thought to be effective to treat poison ivy. Here are just a few. Apple cider vinegar burns at first, baking soda paste, Epsom salt or oatmeal baths, chamomile tea bag compresses, aloe vera gel mixed with various essential oils such as tea tree, lemon, lavender, peppermint, geranium, and chamomile, and jewel weed, mash and apply. There are many others. Natural or commercial creams and ointments should be dabbed on as opposed to rubbed, which may cause more irritation and slow healing. In the worst cases, prescription medicines like Medrol may be needed to speed recovery and prevent complications. The good news is that even if you don't treat the rash, it will go away by itself over 2 to 3 weeks in most cases. Prevention. The best prevention is to avoid getting the toxin on your skin. If you can't avoid exposure, make sure to wear long pants, long sleeve shirts, work gloves, and boots if you're doing work in areas known to harbor poison plants. Some recommend an over-the-counter lotion called IVX as a preventative. Apply it like you would a sunblock to likely areas of exposure. Theoretically, it prevents the oil from being absorbed by your skin. The effects of poison ivy, oak, or sumac can make you miserable and even cause secondary infections, something that will decrease your work efficiency in the great outdoors. If you know how to identify these plants and be aware of your surroundings, you'll have less headaches off the grid. All right, so like I said, there are links here that you'll want to go check out. And then I think it's also helpful to look at the pictures of poison oak and poison ivy and poison sumac to get you, get you a good idea of what they look like. You might even want to, print some of these out if you're creating like an outdoor journal or even like a foraging or wild edible journal where you're printing things off. This might be one of those like, hey, watch out for these type things where you, you look at them on a regular basis before you go out, or if you need to just kind of match them up. So that might be a good idea. But go check out Poison Ivy, Oak, and others over at doomandbloom.net. What I like about Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy's website is they have a little button that says printer friendly, and so you can print off their articles if you think you'd like to add them to one of your preparedness notebooks. Our next article comes to us from theprepperjournal.com. This one's titled, What is Your Prepper Resume? And at first, when I first saw the title, I was like, oh, come on, but I totally understand where it's coming from when you read this article, and haven't really come across one of these here recently, so I think it's a good one to read and to think about, and to get you to think about your skills and where you are, and how valuable your skills actually are. So let's go ahead and read this one. After the SHTF and it stops falling from the sky and you're alone, where will you go? Will you be a lone wolf or a member of a community of friends? What is your backup plan if you need to join a community of strangers? What will you bring to the table? How can you convince a group to take you on as a member? How do you sell yourself? Most preppers think about hoarding supplies, bugging in, and riding out the storm in their basement, but the fact is, accumulated skills are more important than what you can carry with you in a backpack. Not to mention, the chance of survival in groups can be multitudes higher than trying to go solo. There are a myriad of skills that are helpful in our current world, but if we're in a world without rule of law, certain skills stand out, presenting value in a long-term survival situation. Let's discuss an obvious one first, marksmanship. Proficiency with a rifle, pistol, or shotgun are important for community defense and hunting. This is a cornerstone of most preppers' repertoire, and while definitely a skill to not ignore, it simply doesn't stand out when petitioning to join a community. More likely than not, the role is already filled by some of the existing members. However, if you contain a high aptitude such as long-range shooting, or you're carrying a rare weapon such as an automatic machine gun, you carry more value. This isn't to say you shouldn't develop your marksmanship, but you better bring your A game if you want to impress the survivalist community. If you don't have any experience in this area, Here's how to start. Go buy a 22 long rifle and get to the range in your area. 22 caliber is cheap to shoot and won't bruise your shoulder with recoil. I'm partial to the Ruger 10/22. It was my first gun. Practice progressively from 10 meters up to 100 meters. Focus on your breathing and trigger pulls. Be in control. Next, grab a 22 long rifle pistol. It'll use the same ammo from your rifle, making logistics simpler. Practice from 3 meters out to about 10 meters. Again, focus on your breathing and trigger control. Now buy a 12 or 20 gauge shotgun along with a bunch of birdshot, number 7 to number 9, and go to a range and shoot a trap course. If you've done these things and consider yourself proficient, I won't have to tell you what to do next. You'll know. If you're particularly adept at harvesting and gardening, you have more value than the average Joe. The majority of Americans experience gardening as an herb set they keep in their windowsill. The clear majority are clueless when it comes to growing a backyard tomato garden. Knowing when to plant, when to harvest, and which plants complement each other is a great value for a long-term survival situation. I'd estimate that more often than not, preppers have at least dabbled in this area, and therefore you'd really have to set yourself apart to showcase value. One way to do so is to show an ability to handle livestock or even raise chickens. Fewer preppers have had the opportunity to raise live animals. This is an excellent way to demonstrate worth. If you're green in this area, start small and work up progressively. Grow some potted basil, mint, or other herbs in your windowsill. If you've got the space, plant a few low-maintenance vegetables. You'll maybe have more success buying pre-planted pots and transferring them, but you can be successful on your first try with seeds. I was. Easy varieties could include cucumbers or tomatoes. Learn about the climate in your area, frost dates, and soil mixture for your chosen veggie. Find out the do's and don'ts of watering plants, if and how you should prune your plants, and how to harvest. Find out which plants go well together and which can be planted in the same place in subsequent years. What kind of fertilizer should you be using, Epsom salt or eggshells. If you don't have space at your apartment, find a community garden or grow indoors with an aquaponic system. Learn now or be hungry later. Household skills such as cooking, cleaning, mending, etc. aren't particularly flashy skills to have, but they are the lifeblood of a camp, second only to perimeter security. It's the monotonous day-to-day tasks that keep things running, and it's a task that often rotated among members of a group, perhaps taking them away from a skill they're more adept at. Peeling potatoes or replacing buttons on a jacket won't make you stand out, but having minimal skills in the area demonstrate that you won't be a complete burden to the community and can contribute a warm body to the day-to-day mundane task. If you're an adult and don't have basic skills in this area, reevaluate your entire lifestyle now. Enroll in a cooking class, join a sewing club, and practice at home. Understand that while you may do all of these tasks now, after the crash, there will be additional challenges and inconveniences. There will be no washer and dryer to just throw your clothes in and select a spin cycle, and likely no running water at all. You'll be cooking over an open flame, and it'll be orange, not blue. How will you spice up a dish that you and your family have eaten for the past 4 days in a row to make it more palatable, especially with kids? Can you repurpose torn jeans into something useful? How about curing meats or canning food for less prosperous months? Do you know how to make candles and soap? Get these skills under your belt sooner rather than later. Medical skills don't even need to be presented here as an encouragement to augment your skill set. Skills encompassing first aid such as CPR, basic wound care, trauma wound care, emergency pharmaceutical treatment should be within the capability of any long-term survival camp. Knowing how to place emergency sutures or inserting an airway on an unconscious patient are life-saving techniques. The knowledge of how to place a tourniquet, control a fever, or reduce inflammation are essential skills. Even something as simple as a bug bite or small cut can become deadly or debilitating if not treated properly. Start at the local Red Cross. They offer many free classes, CPR and first aid being first in your arsenal of medical skills. See if there is a CERT program active in your area, as they offer additional skills relating to disaster relief such as trauma, care, and triaging procedures. Find a pharmacy technician course, a phlebotomy course, enroll in a nursing program. They're not cheap, but often value can't be accurately measured in fiat currency. You'll hopefully learn the difference between many common painkillers, such as drug interactions to avoid, how to start an IV, and how to place sutures, among other awesome skills. If you can find an EMT level 1 course in your area, take it. Being highly proficient with medical skills would almost guarantee you a place in the ranks. And let me add, just with, you know, on this medical side of it, using herbs and or, you know, medicinal herbs, and knowing you know, how to use them, how to dry them, what they're good for, those kinds of things, I think that would be very, very helpful as well. It's not mentioned here in this article, but if you think about it, eventually, you know, all the drugs that are out there are going to be used up. And if you know how to forage and wildcraft, you know, medicinal herbs out there, and then how to apply them to keep people healthy or to help them, I think that would be very, very valuable to people. And so that's something that you can definitely learn now as well. Being good with your hands with mechanical or handyman skills will serve you well in long-term survival situations. Keeping small machinery running, such as generators, motorcycles, quads, and larger diesel tractors, should be an easy sell for a community lacking in such a person, but two is one and one is none. Knowing how to construct or repair buildings, build solar generators, or properly put up a fence can make all the difference in not only comfort, but survival. Don't kid yourself about your own abilities when it hits the fan, but putting up picture frames on the wall or putting together IKEA furniture isn't going to cut it. This is a broad subject to jump into, so find something that interests you. Build a small solar farm at your house and use it to power your entertainment system and charge your electronics, or as a backup on your fridge in case your grid power is lost. Build a custom frame for your solar panels out of wood. Construct raised beds for a garden in your backyard. Run plumbing for that new garden you're building, and a rain collection and water filtration system while you're at it. Change the oil in your car and rotate the tires yourself. Brake squealing? Change your pads and perhaps the rotors. Get your hands dirty. You'll appreciate the calluses later. Those practice that communication hold an often undervalued position in a world without rule of law situation. Communications include both those with skills around radio communication, such as ham, CB, and GMRS, but also those who have proficiency in a foreign language. This latter skill is often overlooked and can prove extremely valuable for processing information discovered via the former. Those listening to shortwave or ham radio months after a collapse may receive broadcasts in a language other than English. Encountering other groups after the fall can lead to a potential conflict if there isn't a mutual understanding between the two groups. This is particularly important if the camp is proximate to a border. Examples would be those groups near the southern border of the United States having a Spanish speaker among them, and those near the northern border having a French speaker. If you studied some Spanish or French in high school, start brushing up on it. If not, enroll in a class at your local community college, or there are even free online courses. Pick a language that would be likely to have a value in your area or that are likely to be encountered. Spanish, French, Chinese, Mandarin, Arabic, and Russian are common additional languages to adopt that can be put into play when listening to international radio, all of them plus English being the official languages adopted by the United Nations. For radio communications, grab a CB radio and take it with you in the car and practice. See how far the waves travel on the open road versus in a city, and what antenna positions give you a better signal. Grab FRS radios and learn the limitations of these type of radios as you play in the park with your kids. Getting your amateur radio technician class and general class will open up a whole world for you. Learn Morse code. Information is powerful. Redundancy in a skill set is mandatory for survival of a community. Any downtime of members in an organization should be spent cross-training in other areas to make the group more well-rounded and resilient in case of catastrophe. While the internet and YouTube are still around, soak in as much information as you can, as this resource won't be around when you need it after the crash. More important than passively learning is applying it in practice. Learn from mistakes now while you have a safety net. Consider building yourself a proper library with books on these skills mentioned and more. They'll survive an EMP, can help fill in the gaps in knowledge, and make passing on skills to new members simpler. Never stop improving yourself in case you find yourself sitting for an interview to survive. There's a few comments here that you can go check out, and a lot of links on this article as well. So something to consider there. What would you be able to bring to the table if that was the case? If you had to leave where you were and you had to link up with some other people for survival, mutual survival, protection, those kinds of things. Why would they want you in their group? What do you bring to the table? What kind of knowledge do you have? What kind of skill set do you have? Things to consider there. And if this happened today, or this happened tomorrow, what would you have? So that might be something to think about, and so you can start applying it now. All right, so that's prepperjournal.com. All right, so let's go to our last article of the podcast. This comes to us from askaprepper.com, and it's the title is DIY Mosquito Trap That Really Works. And you're going to want to go to this website, because it has pictures to kind of walk you through the whole DIY process on doing this. Now, you always see these on Facebook, right? And people make them and different things like that. I've heard various accounts. Some people that I know have said that they work. Other people, like, no, they don't work. It depends on what you use, those kinds of things. And even in this, even in the comments in this article, there's a person who says, no, this doesn't work. It hasn't worked for me. And, there's 25 comments in here. So, one of the things, I guess, that's different that I've seen in this one than others is the solution that they're telling you to make. I don't recall seeing that in some of the other ones that I've seen. And so let's go ahead and read this one. But again, you're going to want to go check out these pictures. All right. In summertime, one of the main things that keep people from enjoying their outdoor space is mosquitoes. Nothing ruins a backyard barbecue or even just a relaxing evening outside faster than a swarm of mosquitoes attacking your skin. While there are some solutions for a mosquito problem, most of them are pricey, made from possibly toxic chemicals, and require frequent reapplication. If you're looking for a chemical-free and cheap solution to a mosquito problem, look no further. You can make your own mosquito trap for less than $5 worth of ingredients. There may be a lot of traps out there, but this one uses the mosquito's natural behavior to trap them. Just like the pitcher plant which lures bugs into its belly, this trap uses a bait liquid that attracts the flying pests into a plastic bottle with a funnel top that keeps them stuck inside. The best part? It only takes minimal DIY skills to make. Materials for the trap: a 2-liter plastic soda bottle, scissors or a craft knife, duct tape, black paper, or other opaque material. How to make the mosquito trap. To make the trap, you first wash out your plastic bottle and remove the label. You can use any type of plastic bottle, but we found that a 2-liter works best. Using your craft knife, cut around the top of the bottle just under where it starts to narrow into the neck. It can be helpful to draw a line with a permanent marker. Be careful with your craft knife. If you don't have one, you can always cut a small hole with a regular knife, then cut around the bottle using scissors. Take off the top, turn the top of the bottle upside down, and put it inside the body of the plastic bottle so it makes a funnel, then tape in place with your duct tape. Now, in the picture they have, when they turned it upside down and put the funnel into the other piece of the plastic, one of the pieces doesn't show the bottle top off, but just know that you're going to take that one off, and I'll come back to that one actually in just a minute. The top of the bottle funnels the mosquitoes into the body of the bottle. Once in the bottle, they aren't equipped to turn around and fly back. Cover your bottle with something opaque, such as black or craft paper, vinyl sheets, or even duct tape. You can wrap it after you add the liquid to check the level of the liquid in the bottle. The bottle needs to be covered because mosquitoes like dark places, and they will be more drawn to the bottle. Ingredients for the bait liquid: 1 cup of boiling water, 1 cup of cold water, 3/4 cup of sugar water, and 1 packet of active dry yeast, about 2 teaspoons. Boil. How to make the mosquito bait liquid. Boil 1 cup of water and then add 3/4 of sugar to make a simple syrup. Once the sugar is completely dissolved, pour it into a heat-safe bowl. Then add your cup of cold water and allow it to cool. Following the directions on the package, add 1 packet of active dry yeast, or 2 teaspoons if you don't have the pre-measured packets. This is the kind of yeast used for baking, not brewer's yeast or nutritional yeast. You add it to lukewarm water, no hotter than 90 degrees Fahrenheit, to encourage growth without killing off the yeast, as it will die at higher temperatures. Pour this liquid into the container, making sure that it doesn't reach the neck of the bottle so the bugs have a space to fly all the way in. Why does this mosquito trap work so well? The trap uses the natural instincts of these airborne pests to draw them into a place they can't escape. Mosquitoes are attracted by carbon dioxide, and the combination of yeast and sugar water releases the carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide rises from the opening in the bottle to attract the mosquitoes. They fly into the cloud of gas and then down into the bottle to check out the sugar water, as well guided by the funnel. The black covering on the trap draws them as well, especially the female mosquitoes, who like a dark place to breed. Once inside the bottle, the mosquitoes can't turn around and fly back out. The key to these traps is put more than one out and combine them with other control methods. While they will attract and trap some mosquitoes, they are just so many of the flying pests that they can't completely clear an area. So while your DIY mosquito trap will catch some bugs for you, always remember to also pour out any standing water, plant mosquito repellent plants like lavender or burn citronella candles. These DIY traps are a great addition to a natural mosquito control arsenal. All right, so when I said I was going to go back to the bottle part, one of the suggestions was the sugar water will attract bees as well, and so we don't want to lose bees as much as possible. So one idea was to leave the bottle top on and then kind of drill out a smaller hole so flies and mosquitoes and stuff could actually get in there, but maybe, you know, it would be a little bit harder for bees to do that. So something to consider. There's a couple of pictures here. It looks like they have a lot of flies. At least, you know, it looks dirty, but it looks like it's working. So I don't know. Curious, you know, hey, if you've done one of these and you have had success, let me know. Let me know if you've what you did, if you did anything different. You know, one of the things I like to do when I'm messing around in the garden, planting in the garden, is I like to do marigolds, and I put them in planters, and I keep them away from, keep them out kind of in the yard and water them all in one place. But if people are coming over and we're sitting out on the porch, I like to bring those out and I just spread them out and try to do that early on in the day and just, create that, that environment so bugs will want to stay away. I mean, and I also plant some in my garden beds as well. So, there's a lot of ways to kind of do it, but yeah, fighting with bugs, especially when you're out there and you want to enjoy the outdoors kind of sucks, but go check this one out, and it's worth a try, right? I mean, why not? It's worth a try to see if it will work, putting them out there and doing that. So go check those out. A lot of good articles today, good information. If you get a chance, come by the Prepper website, podcast.com, and leave me a message in the comment section, or I'd appreciate it if you share out our episodes, on social media. Hey, I also appreciate it when we get reviews on iTunes and Stitcher and other places. Right now, iTunes, we've had a few recent reviews, and it's always appreciated because that helps with the algorithms on iTunes. And I can tell this last week and this week, we have an increase in just the downloads, and it kind of jumped. And so you kind of see a plateau every once in a while, and then it jumps. And so I was glad to see that, and I appreciate that. Hey, thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for listening to the Prepper Website Podcast. I really do appreciate it, and I'm trying my best out there to put out some good content for you, and hopefully you're enjoying it. All right, with that, choose to live a more self-reliant life. Choose not to be so dependent on the government grid or the grind. Until tomorrow, stay prepped and aware. Peace.